You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are 37 days into the stay-at-home order, and smartphone tracking data suggests that a small but rising number of Wisconsinites are growing tired of pandemic-driven constraints and maybe moving around more. So what's been the hardest part about limiting your mobility during the pandemic? Are you taking new exposure risks that you know maybe not be a good idea? What do you want to know about digital tracking data in the pandemic? We're at 800-642-1234. Will Cushman is associate editor of WisconText, and his reporting looks at how cell phone data shows the ways that Wisconsinites have changed their movement during the pandemic. Will, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So companies are able to use cell phone data to really track with really good precision how people are moving around. What do we know about this data and what it shows?
That's right. So this data comes from mostly smartphone apps that track your location. For the most part, these are apps that track your location ostensibly with the user's knowledge. So it's usually apps such as like a map or navigation app that provides you with directions for where you want to go, or maybe a ride sharing app. But these apps, they track your location pretty much all the time or while you're using them. And then those app developers will sell that data to vendors who then sell it to others. And some of them have made it public.
And so basically you have to look on your settings to know whether you are actually opting in and sharing such data on those apps?
Exactly. Yep. So I actually just looked at my phone and I realized that some apps that I didn't realize were tracking my location do track my location while I'm using the app. And you can adjust those settings depending on the operating system that you have. But I would venture to guess that quite a number of people aren't aware of how many apps are tracking their location as frequently as they are.
Well, right, because you might forget to turn it off once you've turned it on to use the app and to get from maybe point A to point B or something, and then you have to go back and readjust your settings.
Exactly, yep. And I think a lot of app developers have been getting better about letting users know when and why they are going to be tracking their location. As concerns over privacy have increased related to smartphones, as I think just more and more people are using smartphones. But there still definitely, I think, is a big chunk of the population who probably is not super aware of just how finely they're being tracked. And they're being tracked anonymously. So as a reporter looking at this location tracking data that was provided by a third-party vendor who bought it from an app developer, am not able to tell, like, oh, Joe Smith from Appleton went to Home Depot today or something like that. This data is anonymized and it's aggregated and it's based on samples. So it can tell you about kind of like community movement trends, but it can't tell me who exactly is moving and where exactly they're going.
How big of a sample size were you able to look at?
So that comes from the companies who provided the data. So I looked at data from Google. They made public a bunch of data related to movement all over the United States and I believe the world, kind of wanting to look at the effects of these lockdown orders, safer at home orders. And then I also looked at data provided by a company called Cubic, which is a third-party vendor. They're primarily in the advertising realm, and they will contract with app developers, purchase location data, and then they package it up and sell it to people for companies for various reasons, usually for targeted advertising. And their samples are large enough to be, I guess, to be able to make significant claims about the general movement patterns of people in most places in Wisconsin. The data from Google did leave something to be desired for some smaller communities. In fact, Google said that they couldn't really provide finely detailed data for a whole bunch of counties with just smaller populations.
We're talking with Will Cushman, an associate editor of WisconText. We're exploring what cell phone data tells us about how people are doing with the stay-at-home orders. How have your routines changed over the past couple months? What places did you used to routinely visit that you no longer go? And what routines and places do you miss the most right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Will, what places did Wisconsin residents stop going to? What did you find there?
Yeah, so that got, I looked at Google from data, or excuse me, data from Google for that, and found that people, as you would probably suspect, are visiting retail stores and restaurants to a much less degree. The visits to retail stores and restaurants cratered as much as 60% across the state following the Safer at Home order. People are also visiting grocery stores and pharmacies less, not quite to the same degree as restaurants and other retail, but they're certainly visiting those stores less. It seems that people are probably heeding public health advice and limiting their visits to just kind of for essential needs.
So even the places that people can go, you're seeing from the data a drop in the amount of activity at those places like pharmacies and grocery stores.
Yep. Yep. Also seeing a huge drop in visits to transit stations. So that'd be like bus stops or train stations or airports. Big drop in visits to workplaces, which makes a lot of sense. A lot of people are either laid off and unemployed right now, so not going to work, or working from home. And a big increase in people just kind of staying home, and also saw a big increase at least up through the beginning part of April, which is as far as the Google data is available, big increase in visits to parks.
Oh, and we certainly have seen that as well as playgrounds close and state parks, many of those closed as well because of the influx. When you look at the data across Wisconsin and with Google having difficulty in small communities, what does the patchwork look like? Is the movement uniform around the state or not?
It's not uniform, no. And so for this portion of the data that I looked at, that was data provided by this company called Cubic. And they showed that movement, or at least the number or the percentage of people who are staying home, really kind of varies quite a bit around the state from county to county. The highest rates of people staying home, and they define that as staying within 330 feet of one location in any day. So that's about 100 meters. So they're considering that staying home. The largest percentage of people who are really kind of confining their movement in that way are in like Dane County and then some suburban Milwaukee counties.
We're talking with our partners at Wisconsin about smartphone data movement trends. Will Cushman is here, associate editor. What questions do you have about where people are still going to in Wisconsin? Are you surprised that people are going anywhere but the grocery store and pharmacy? Are you staying close to home and following the Safer at Home orders? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Will Cushman here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how phone data reveals that people are moving around more. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So this is not just in Wisconsin. The median distance traveled each day in the U.S. has started to tick up as well. And the data suggests that the increase in movement is happening before official reopening dates. So what do you want to know about tracking movement and smartphone data? Does the data reflect what you're doing? Are you leaving your home more? If so, where are you going? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We're talking with Will Cushman. He's associate editor at WisconText, and he stays with us. So, Will, when you put Wisconsin's data up against the national data that you're seeing, is Wisconsin in line with what's going on nationwide?
That's a really good question. And I didn't look at that super closely, but from what I can gather, just kind of from a brief look at the data, Wisconsin does align pretty closely with the movement, at least in states that have similar safer at home or stay at home orders. Yes.
Are there any theories for why residents in some areas are moving more than in other places?
There are. So I was really interested in kind of this variation in the number of people who, or the percentage of people in counties who are staying home. As I said right before the break, the highest percentages are in Dane County and then suburban Milwaukee, so like Waukesha County and Ozaukee County. In those three counties, about half of the population is staying home, according to this data that I've been looking at. But I also wanted to know, like, how many more people than usual are staying home. So I averaged the kind of like the percentage of people on average who are staying home after the safer at home order went into effect on March 24th, with the average and maybe like the, it was about like the 6 weeks before the safer at home order went into effect, and found that the percentage of people, or the number of people who are staying home like more than is usual, is actually kind of, it seems to be associated with larger urban centers, southeastern Wisconsin, Green Bay, the Fox Cities, and then also counties that hold or have a UW four-year campus. So like Portage County, Eau Claire County, La Crosse County, Grant County. And it seems that the places where people are staying home more are places where people are just able to stay home more because of where they work, whether it's a campus that has closed and taken instruction and working online, or communities that have a large portion of workers who work in management or maybe legal professions who are able to work from home more easily.
Oh, so like counties. Wealth and class could factor into this.
Exactly. Yeah. So I talked to a researcher from UW who, she hasn't really looked at this data very closely, but she said that totally tracks, that communities with more wealth, with more people working and at kind of like the top of the labor force, you'll probably see less movement in those communities than in communities where there are people who are still having to report to work in person in larger numbers, those essential workers. But she also said that
in service jobs.
In service jobs, yeah, like so at grocery stores or caregivers at nursing homes, et cetera. But she also said that the data is going to get muddled because there are also a lot of people in service jobs who are out of a job right now. And so they probably are not moving around as much either. So the data is it tells kind of like a half of the story, I would say.
Yeah, not as clean cut as possible. Will Cushman here, associate editor with Wisconsin Text. We're looking at what smartphone data is telling telling us about how people are doing with stay-at-home orders. With your insights, your questions, what's been the hardest part about limiting your mobility during the pandemic? Are you starting to venture out more, and why? What do you want to know about smartphone data tracking? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Will, the controversial election on April 7th, what did that date look like with the data?
That's a really good question. I talked to a researcher from UW who is heading up a team who's looking at location tracking data for a number of reasons, but they kind of wanted to see what that data said about the election on April 7th and in-person voting, and whether or not that affected people's movement patterns. And they found that there wasn't a huge difference in kind of large urban centers like Madison and Milwaukee in terms of movement on election day with the day prior or other days around then. But they did see a noticeable uptick in the median travel distance. So that's kind of like essentially the average distance that people are traveling in any county. They saw an uptick in a lot of rural counties, so Lafayette County, but then also some suburban counties or counties with larger communities as well, so Rock County, Waukesha County. But the differences that they saw were not across the board. They varied quite a bit around the state on election day.
Well, let's turn our attention here to public health officials who are hoping to use this type of data to find out who has come into contact with people known to have the coronavirus. What is known about contact tracing and what our smartphones can do with it?
That's another really good question. And I think people who are concerned about their privacy are probably really quite concerned about that. So I can tell you that the data that I looked at and what the researchers at UW were looking at, that is, while being kind of related to how some nations are using location tracking data for contact tracing, it's a pretty different beast. And that's because that data is aggregated, it's anonymized, it's based on samples, whereas using location tracking data to contact trace requires being able to know where an individual is and where they're going and where they've been. And so I know there is talk in some parts of the country, Utah, for instance, about creating or using an app that asks people to opt in. And it would be an app specifically for contact tracing. And you would volunteer and opt into the service and know that you are being tracked, where you as an individual are going is being tracked. And you're saying, I'm okay with that because I want to be able to move around more, go about my daily life. And if this is a way to maybe get there, I'll do it. The UW researcher I talked to said that for those apps to be effective, if one like that were to be made available in Wisconsin, he said it would need 60% of the population to opt into it.
I've also heard that some large companies are developing apps or programs that would turn on when the employee enters the building so that it can trace who the employee came in contact with, and therefore it would be easier to trace those contacts if an outbreak happens inside the walls of that company.
Yeah, I've heard similar things too. And I think there's talk about not only using the data that's tracked via cell towers, but also when you're maybe in a grocery store, like having Bluetooth, being able to track where you are, even like in that grocery store, down to a pretty fine detail. So they can know if someone ended up being infected with COVID-19 and they had visited a grocery store a couple of days earlier, they could, authorities or a contact tracer could go through data and see who they came in close contact with in that specific store. That's stuff that's happening in some other countries like Singapore and South Korea. It's not happening in the US yet. We'll see if enough people are willing to opt into that.
So, Will, as you've been researching this, how do you think this digital data is going to factor in how we fight the coronavirus and get a handle on it? How important is this?
I think it's going to be increasingly important, as we just talked about, in terms of contact tracing. The state of Wisconsin is looking to hire like 1,000 contact tracers right now. But from what I've heard, that might not even be enough to get the state to where it wants to be in contact tracing. So the ability to leverage this data that's out there, I think, could be quite attractive in a lot of ways. There are obviously some privacy concerns related to that, but I think it's going to be really important going forward.
Well, Will, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Kate. Appreciate it.
Will Cushman is an associate editor of WisconText, and his recent article looked at how cell phone data shows the ways that Wisconsinites have changed their movement during the pandemic. You can find more at wisconText.org. Coming up, we get an update on the status of coronavirus testing at the state hygiene lab. That is coming up after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Just a quick mention here that there are so many questions surrounding COVID-19, and our Wisconsin project is collecting questions. Submit yours about COVID-19. We'll do our best to answer it. Go to WPR.org/COVID. Right now, we're checking in on the status of testing for the coronavirus in Wisconsin. Governor Evers' plans for reopening the economy partially depend on the state seeing a 14-day decline in the ratio of positive tests. And a Republican-backed plan supported by business groups would also monitor how often COVID-19 tests come back positive. So what questions do you have about testing? Have you asked your healthcare provider about getting a test? What was their response? How long did it take for you to get results back? We're at 800-642-1234. Alan Bateman is the Assistant Director of Communicable Diseases at the State Hygiene Lab. Alan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
All right. So lots of numbers, but the state health department says our daily testing capacity is about 11,000 samples right now. How much of that capacity falls on your shoulders under the hygiene lab?
Sure. So I guess to take a step back, there's about 50 labs in the state now that can do testing. And we really have it's been wonderful to see additional labs come online, and we've worked with a lot of the different clinical labs around the state to be able to increase this statewide capacity. Here at Wisconsin State Lab, we have ramped up our response and our testing 7 days a week, and our estimated capacity is 500 per day. On a given day, we might get less than that or more than that. It really depends on what specimens come in and what outbreaks we're responding to.
I think Governor Evers has a goal of 12,000 tests a day. Is that conceivable? Is that something that our state can do?
I do believe it is possible. We've been in very close contact with the clinical labs, and we've surveyed them for what their expected capacity is on a given day. Obviously, there are many things that go into that. Reagents are a very limiting factor, and we need the actual specimens to come in. We can only test as many that come in. But using those estimates from each of the labs that are up and running right now is where that number of around 11,000 comes from. So it is still an estimate, and every lab estimates things slightly differently, but that's each lab's best guess at this point for what they could conceivably handle in a day as a maximum.
When we last talked with you in mid-March, there were shortages on reagents. It was hard for you to gauge the supply line on getting the things that you need to do these tests, these chemicals. Are you still seeing shortages in the supply chain?
Yes, that's a good question. And yes, we still are seeing supply chain issues with some of the reagents. These include the swabs and the media, the liquid that the swab goes into to then be transported to a lab, as well as the testing reagents themselves. There are many different companies now that have COVID PCR tests, which are the diagnostic tests. And it's fantastic to have that many additional companies' tests out there. It's definitely not just the CDC's test anymore that's available. But depending on the company, depending on the time, there are still pretty significant limitations in reagents and supplies.
Does that hold back the number of tests that can be processed?
It depends. Right now, It's kind of spotty around the state. There are certain labs that have multiple different manufacturers' tests in their lab to be able to continue testing, even if there's a back order in one or more of those reagents. Other labs may or may not have that ability at this point. And depending on which company's instruments they have in their lab, they may be more hamstrung by reagents. So across the state, it's kind of spotty whether or not there are major reagent limitations or not in any given lab.
What about the expense of these reagents and other supplies needing to carry out these tests? Have you seen changes in the costs of these products?
We haven't seen major changes from any other normal cost of an influenza PCR test or a test for another type of pathogen. It's been pretty consistent across the board overall, which has been really good to see.
How much does the COVID-19 PCR test cost right now?
Yeah, that's a good question and hard to answer directly. The supplies and reagents themselves vary by company, and often many of the tests that we're running need many different ingredients into there, which can be different costs. And then that's just the reagents and supply side. There's also all of the manpower time and the personnel time to enter all the information in, to actually do the test and do the resulting and whatnot. So it's really hard to put even a rough estimate on that because it varies by lab.
When you look at the human power time for your lab, the state hygiene lab, and look at testing capacity, how do you see yourself scaling up or not?
So we already have been able to scale up to a certain degree, and we are within our capacity right now. And we are continuing to cross-train people to be able to step in to test as well. And we're also considering additional manufacturing lines, as you would, for testing to be able to have more throughput if needed.
How does the cross-training work, and especially since you're not able to be side-by-side with someone in that cross-training, does it take longer?
The cross-training, thankfully, we already have a decent number of well-trained microbiologists that do testing across many different types of pathogens. So training them to do this specific COVID PCR test doesn't take nearly as long as hiring someone new and getting them up to speed with all of their training. So that's been really nice. In terms of working closely with each other, we do have a PPE policy to limit the possibility of the virus going from one employee to another.
And the PPE, the personal protection equipment, the masks, the gloves, the other supplies that you need to stay safe there. We're talking with Alan Bateman from the State Hygiene Lab. He's the lab's assistant director of communicable diseases. What questions do you have about coronavirus testing here in Wisconsin? What do you want to know? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Alan, you know, we've been throwing out this terminology you have about PCR testing. This is diagnostic testing. And if I understand this correctly, it detects the virus's genetic material. Can you help us better understand what a PCR test is?
Sure. And yes, you're right. The PCR test does detect the virus itself. It targets a particular small section of the virus's genome. And with those specific reagents, it amplifies that part to be able to detect it. There's a cycling between cycling in heat between very hot and not as hot that goes back and forth that allows the reagents to take one strand of genome and multiply it into millions of copies over an hour or two. And that's how we're able to detect such low levels by this PCR test. And one nice thing about the PCR test is that it's very sensitive. If the virus is there, it's very sensitive in picking it up. It's the gold standard test at this point for diagnostics.
Gold standard because then you have a lot more assurance in this test that, you know, positive tests don't come back negative, negative don't come back positive.
Exactly. Yes, PCR tests are both very sensitive and specific to make sure that they're as accurate as possible. There are many different steps in an entire test process, including the specimen collection, and if that's a good specimen, and then that transportation to a lab. But if the virus is there and the specimen was collected correctly, a PCR test is our best test at identifying it.
How long do the steps take from, and I know that, you know, it could take perhaps over a day to actually get that specimen into your lab, but how long does it take to process a test?
And that really depends on the test itself. There are some that are rapid, sort of point of care, they're called, and those are 15 minutes to an hour. You can have one test result, but that's one test result. And we're doing batches of many, 50 or 100 at a time. And those, the very, very fastest is potentially 3 to 4 hours. And that's if you have low numbers of specimens. There are a couple major steps along the way, including all that data entry to get all the patient information and the specimen information form into our system. So depending on the number of specimens we have, if a specimen comes in first thing in the morning, we could have results out that same day. Otherwise, next day, and our stated, it's called turnaround time from when the specimen gets to our lab until it is resulted is 24 to 48 hours. And that's a very standard turnaround time for this type of testing.
Let's take a call now. Jim is joining us from Freedom this morning. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I saw an article on the internet the other day said that in New York they tested to see if people had antibodies in their system to fight off the coronavirus, and it showed in New York alone 14% of the people randomly tested showed they already had antibodies in them. And I'm wondering if Wisconsin's doing the same thing, because if that's the case in New York, that means 1.4 million people in New York have already had it. And then a week later, I read they did the same thing. It was 20%. So that means 2 million people. And yet in the news, we keep hearing that only we just got 1 million people showed positive. Well, if this is correct in New York and it's similar things happening all over the country, we're talking 20, 30 million already people in our country probably already had it. Actually, more like 60 million.
Jim, thank you. Short on time here, but PCR tests different from antibody tests, Alan.
Yes, the PCR test identifies the virus itself, whereas the antibody test, the serology test, identify the immune response to the virus. That immune response is identifiable more like a week or two after symptom onset, as opposed to right away like PCR tests are. And yes, there have been many studies, both in the U.S. and globally, to get a sense of how many people have detectable antibodies. And the New York numbers are the highest that I've seen, the 14 to 20%, potentially a little bit higher than that. A lot of the other ones that are coming back are somewhere between 2% and 4% of people tested that have detectable antibodies. And I'll also add that having detectable antibodies, it's not currently known if that provides protection against infection or how long that protection might last. That's all still being investigated, and over time we'll learn a lot more about that.
We have Alan Bateman with us, the Assistant Director of Communicable Diseases at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. We're looking at the testing situation here in our state, which has 50 active testing labs. What questions do you have about testing for COVID-19? Are you confused about the difference between the PCR test that detects the virus's genetic material versus the antibody test that we've been talking about? And now there's this antigen test. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Alan Bateman right here on the Ideas Network. We're getting updates on the status of coronavirus testing here in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over the past few weeks, testing for antibodies has been in the news, as Jim and Freedom had talked about. Antibodies are proteins that help fight off infections, and doctors are studying whether antibodies from recovered coronavirus patients can help others battling the disease. And the research has led to more interest in antibody testing. So what do you want to know about it? What questions do you have about antibodies and how doctors are using them? Have you tested positive for the coronavirus or antibodies? What has your experience been like? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Alan Bateman from the State Hygiene Lab stays with us. So, Alan, as we were talking there, how much testing for the coronavirus antibodies is happening here in Wisconsin?
The antibody tests for coronavirus are up and coming. The real focus early on and still for the diagnostic testing is the PCR. So that was the real focus for bringing up capacity initially. There are quite a few different hospital systems and labs that are looking into or starting to think about testing for antibodies in Wisconsin. And there are also some of the national reference labs that you can send outside of the state to get antibody testing currently.
How is testing for antibodies different from testing for the virus, for the PCR test, the diagnostic?
It's some of the same companies that are involved, okay. But the instrumentation is definitely different, and the throughput, the amount of specimens that can be tested, depending on the instrument, can be quite high for the antibodies, which that is a really good thing to know. But there are many different instruments out there that identify total antibodies against the virus or specific classes of the antibodies, IgG or IgM. So there are many different approaches being taken.
We've also heard, and not to get the waters more murky here, but there's antigen testing out there that looks at the proteins that stud the outer surface of the virus. What do we know there?
Yes, so that's another approach. For influenza, there have been antigen tests for a long time. And I know it does get confusing, antibodies versus antigen. The antigens, as you mentioned, identify proteins of the virus. So it's also identifying the virus itself. We have found over the years with influenza antigen tests that they're not as sensitive as the PCR, and that's why the PCR is the standard diagnostic go-to at this point. The antigen tests have yet to be fully developed and evaluated yet, but if they are equivalently sensitive, they could add additional help to this testing.
Let's take another call now. Lisa is with us from Madison this morning. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
I understand you're a nurse.
I am.
What can you tell us?
My question is, I was tested on March 18th. I had symptoms, and at that time, the state lab was requiring us to answer three questions to find out what tier you were in. And I think I was in the second tier because I was a healthcare worker with symptoms, but I had no fever. So my test was taken, sent to the state lab, and then I got information back that my test sample was simply frozen. And I'm curious if that's ever going to be run. And my concern was, as a healthcare worker, I was working and exposing hundreds of people, and the state lab never ran my test.
Thanks very much for your question. Yeah, March, that week in March was quite busy for us, and we were one of the only labs that was doing testing at that point. So we needed to set in that prioritization and have the tiers 1, 2, and 3. And for the second tier, some of them got tested, but not all of them. And that was what we had to put in at that point because the numbers of specimens coming in were more than we could handle at that week.
How many specimens are left in the freezer now?
That's a good question. I would have to get back to you on that.
Is Lisa alone here? Did you, during that time in March, when there weren't that many, just a handful of labs doing the work you do, was that the best thing that you could do at that point, is just to freeze those specimens and then be able to get back to them at a later date?
So one of the things we have offered for those specimens is to have them sent back to the sending lab for testing there, or sending somewhere else to another lab that could handle it. Nationwide, the testing capacity is much better now. The national reference labs can handle a lot more. compared to what they could back in mid-March as well. So we are overall in a much, much better position statewide and nationwide for PCR testing now.
You wouldn't characterize PCR testing to be in a backlog situation in Wisconsin right now?
Currently, we don't have a backlog for the specimens coming in right now, and we haven't heard of a ton of backlogs across the state, but it depends on the lab and on what availability of reagents they have in that particular system.
Lisa, may I ask, how are you feeling today?
If I was positive, I'm fully recovered now, so I feel fine. But again, for tracing purposes, you know, I'm curious what happens to that frozen sample and will it ever be run, because it could be tied to many other people that at that time, they were not tested. They were just told that they were presumed positive. So just again, to make sure that the numbers are more accurate, it'd be nice to run some of those samples.
Yeah, I agree. We want the most accurate numbers possible, both the positives and negatives, and the particularly the deaths. There are definitely some advantages and disadvantages or ability to fully capture all of the data. And we and our partners at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services are doing our best to capture all the data possible. We do realize that there can be weaknesses in every state and country's numbers.
Lisa, were fellow nurses on your floor in a similar situation where they received that information about having their sample frozen?
Yeah.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for calling in and for the work you do. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Stay safe, everyone.
You too. Ellen, when the outbreak first came to Wisconsin, health authorities strictly limited who could be tested. We just heard about this tier system, 1, 2, 3. Who can be tested now?
Thanks for bringing that up. Yes, early on, the number of the people who could be tested had to be prioritized because of the extreme limitation on capacity, and now it has broadened quite a bit. We still have within the public health lab testing, us at the state lab as well as the Milwaukee City lab, we have public health prioritization testing, and that is for people at highest risk, and that those tiers have overgone some change over time to become more broadened. Outside of the public health lab testing, the message has been to test quite broadly, and anyone with any clinician that has a suspicion should be testing. That's been a message that has been put out there for quite a few weeks now by our public health colleagues at the Department of Health Services, and we're seeing a little bit of an uptick, but for a while there, clinically, if someone wasn't super sick, they were told to stay home and that a test wasn't possible, and now that the approach is more those people should be tested also for the public health reasons, even if there is no immediate clinical change that's going to happen based on that test result, to be able to identify as many positives as possible to then follow up through the contact tracing and whatnot after that.
In the last moments we have with you, you know, everyone in the state capitol, lawmakers, everyone's relying on your data and your numbers and plans for how to reopen the economy based on what we're seeing in testing. How reliable is that measure as an indicator of infection rates?
Could you restate that a little bit? Which measure exactly?
Well, how reliable, you know, in terms of the metrics that we're using to be able to judge whether we should reopen our economy, how much do we have to really rely on the outcome of testing and the percentages of people being tested? How critical is that data?
I think it's an important piece of the data. It's by no means everything. I would liken it to an individual patient who comes in with any type of infection. The lab result is one aspect of that, and it needs to be taken into account with all of the clinical information, potentially epidemiologic information about that patient as well. So similarly, at the statewide level, I think the information from testing and the percent positive for PCR, as well as potentially antibody testing in the future, should all be taken together along with many other aspects in terms of deciding.
Ellen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Alan Bateman is Assistant Director of the Communicable Diseases Division at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. Just ahead, we discuss a new survey that found widespread food insecurity and homelessness among student athletes. Are you a student athlete or a parent of one? We hope to hear from you next hour here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.